last case this morning is Neuroptics Incorporated versus Bright Lamp Incorporated, 2022-1059. Mr. Afrasiabi?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning,
Your Honor. May it please the Court. Peter Afrasiabi on behalf of the appellant Neuroptics. Your Honors, I think the core error of the district court here can be seen on page 364, the first sentence, including footnote 2, because that's where the court purports to define pupillometer patent portfolio. And the court's definition is fundamentally impossibly vague, it's indefinite, and there's not any evidence in the record to support the parties ever even themselves considered it. Now, if we look at that definition on page 364, the district court said that pupillometer patents mean pupillometer patents, pupillometer technology, not including pupillometer components, subject to the party's field of use. And it said it meant that as an ordinary term of usage. Now, there's no reference given for how that was an ordinary term of usage. And the case law from Ochoa to Orr to Trendmasters that we cited requires that if you are to assess this definiteness inquiry and look at objective evidence, you have to figure out if it's clearly the term that's used.
Okay, I'm confused about something, just to
sure.
be clear. The opinion at 332 is identical to the opinion at 352? Is it just printed twice?
I think so, Your Honor, yes. And
okay,
so sorry. I was referring, for some reason, I've annotated the one at page 364, that first sentence.
But this is of the district court opinion, page 13, footnote 2.
Correct, page 13 of the district court, the underlying district court opinion.
Okay.
And so,
was there ever any discussion with the district court about this components point and whether it was included or not included within the scope of the release?
No. I mean, it was never discussed by anyone. Neither of the parties ever discussed it. And what's very clear from the record, and it's undisputed, at page 266, paragraph 2, the only discussion between the principals of our clients that led to the email exchange, the only discussion was about the seven patents at issue. That's it. With an express statement by our client that was not controverted, that that's all that was discussed, and there was never an idea of covenanting this entire portfolio when this is a lawsuit about this narrow set of patents. And so all they discussed were the patents. And so when these new terms of components and technology are interjected.
When were they those terms first interjected in front of the district court?
Component was first interjected in front of the district court when they, the other side, gave us their draft settlement brief back and it had the word component in it, or the draft settlement agreement and it had the word component in it. That then got submitted to the district court in the briefing on the underlying motion. Technology only appeared in our very original letter to them where we simply said, we have an IP portfolio on pupillometer technology. Now, we never said PPP, which is sort of this phrase at issue here. We said an IP portfolio. And they never even declared that when they got a letter from us talking about PPP, that they somehow thought it had something to do with that original letter, which never used the phrase. It used a different phrase. And so this is why there's a huge error in the case. We now have a term that no party's ever negotiated for. No one knows what it means. And those three terms, they are not mutually exclusive.
Do we at least know that if there was an agreement, which I understand you think there wasn't, but if there was an agreement, do we at least know that it covers at least the two or up to seven patents that were in the suit?
It only includes the seven patents.
Right.
So
we know that. If we have agreement on that, why isn't that enough to resolve this case if there is an agreement?
Absolutely. Assuming there's an agreement and assuming we know that it's the seven patents, the reason we don't, Your Honor, is because covenant is not defined. All it says is we covenant not to sue you on the PPP. I would agree with you that it's at most the seven, and there's another critical fact here for why it's the seven. If you go to page...
But before you get to that, do we have to decide how much more than the seven it is, or is it enough for us to say at least it's the seven, and maybe there'll be another case where you sue them on patent number 8, and they'll have a defense, and you'll argue it out there?
If you say it's just the seven, the case is fine.
If we say it's at least the seven.
Well, no, because there's no evidence that it could be more than the seven, and this is the point.
I'm probably not being clear in my question.
Sorry.
I understand you want it to be no more than the seven, but if we say it's at least the 7, and anything above 7, 7 to 22 or whatever else is another case for another day. Are we done, or are you insisting, and on what basis, that we have to say today what the full scope of the release is?
We're not done because of this reason. We have no meeting of the minds on the 7, apparently. And that's actually a little unclear because they've never actually said that it's more than 7. They have legal arguments, but factually they never said it's more than 7. But we still don't know the scope of the covenant. It wasn't remotely fleshed out or discussed in any way. Is it future looking? Is it back looking? We understand it only attaches to the one product.
But just to focus, I understand the key point of your answer to Judge Stark's question is that if we don't know whether patents 8 through 22 are included, that's highly material, and there therefore was not a enforceable agreement, so you can't resolve this case, even if we thought it must have been at least the 7.
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so the other fact that's critical here, I think, in the record, which may illuminate the fact
and
that there's...
What is the standard of review we would apply to the district court's determination that there was a sufficiently definite agreement to be an enforceable agreement?
De novo, Your Honors. It's de novo because under...
Is that a federal law question or an Indiana law question, the standard of review?
Well, your standard of review is federal law, but here it actually doesn't matter because they're both identical. The Seventh Circuit employs de novo standard of review to assess whether an agreement exists, and the underlying substantive Indiana law that we cited, the Sands case, the Corson, and the Bailey case, they all say that the existence of an agreement is a question of law within Indiana. So,
how about the element of meeting of the minds? Isn't that a factual finding? Don't we have to consider what the intent was of the parties?
Well, if the evidence, Your Honor, is uncontroverted, you may be able to figure out whether there's a meeting of the minds. But the moment you have controverted evidence as to who understood what, we have an ambiguity. And that means we can't have an enforceable agreement because the predicate for the existence of the agreement is a definiteness and unambiguous term.
Well, the district court said that there was a meeting of the minds. That's an element that needs to be found in order for there to be a valid contract under Indiana law, correct?
There must be a meeting of the minds on all terms, yes.
Okay. And the district court said that there was, right?
That's what the district court said, yes.
And we review that finding or conclusion for what?
De novo. Because the question itself as to whether there's a meeting of the minds, which is necessary to have the existence of a contract, is reviewed de novo in Indiana and in the Seventh Circuit. But here's what I would say. Even if you employ abusive discretion review, it's an abusive discretion to conclude where the only patents at issue and ever discussed were the 2 and maybe the 5 within the family, and where they have admitted at page 327 of the record, it's a party admission, that even they didn't think that PPP included all the patents. And that was a phone call that occurred between the counsel and was memorialized in an email, and it's in the record. And that was then sent to them, and they didn't say, what are you saying? We never said that. I mean, so what we have then is, even within some realm of deference, it's an absolute abuse of discretion. There is no basis to get from PPP to more than 7 patents. There's just nothing in the record. And so the level of deference one would need would border on just complete abdication to be able to say, well, yeah, I guess it means that, when it's not.
Isn't it at least a reasonable interpretation of the record here that the 2 CEOs, as you say, never talked about how many patents were within the scope of the release, and that they didn't talk about it because they both understood all along it was all of your patents? Isn't that at least a reasonable interpretation?
It's not at all reasonable, Your Honor, for this reason. If you go to page 266, what our client said is, in the phone call, I only discussed the 7. We never discussed more than 7, and that's undisputed. Paragraph 2. Page 266. So there's no reasonable way to get to the conclusion that more than 7 were at issue. They've never even offered a declaration themselves saying that they thought more than 7 were at issue. The case is only about 7. The settlement was about the case.
What matters, I think, is what is the objective manifestation of the intent. even if they didn't think in their minds that it was more than seven, if objectively looking at what happened here, one were to say, they never talked about it because it was understood since March 2019 when you sent your first letter, all your patents were on the table, then we should uphold it.
That's wrong, Your Honor, for two reasons. The 2019 letter never said that. It charged them with infringement on the two. And it told them, go look at the other five in the family. We don't know everything your app is doing. So we have five more in the family. Go look at those. The only reference to patents beyond the seven was simply in the letter saying, we're in this space. We've been here. We have a large portfolio. But that was just a statement. We have a large IP portfolio. And then it said, you're infringing this narrow subset. And that's it. The case was about that narrow subset. And in the settlement talks, they only discussed that subset. And they were trying to resolve a case only about the seven patents. What I would also add, Your Honor, is if we get to then the question of whether there was even ever a meeting of the minds, was there an intention to have an agreement here? Or was this just an agreement in principle? If you look at the record, I think it's 288 and 289. If you trace offer, counteroffer, counteroffer back and forth, the principles were only talking about money. And then that's the only time there is a sort of an acceptance. The words okay was in response to the money. They reached it. Then the other side said, we're sending this to our lawyers. There was no statement of great deal. The very next statement was, by both of the lawyers, we need to detail this in a document. And in fact, their lawyer said, we don't want to tell the court to hold the presses because we may still have disagreements. We're not there yet. And that's exactly the language of agreements in principle, which happens all the times in cases.
The record doesn't seem to indicate who and through what mechanism contacted the district court to cancel what there was a session
yes.
set for the next day or something?
Correct. This was on a Friday, and there was a discovery hearing on the Monday, Your Honor. And the record, I can go outside the record and tell you what happened, but the record doesn't show exactly what happened, but a call was made by counsel, and our counsel, to the courtroom deputy.
By your counsel?
Yeah, by our local counsel. We're counsel in California, but we had local counsel in Indiana, and counsel for the other side. They called the courtroom deputy and actually said...
I'm sorry. Both sides' counsel were
both,
on the call?
Both sides' counsel were on the phone,
okay.
speaking to the courtroom deputy for the judge, and said, we've reached an agreement in principle. We've reached some sort of agreement.
So the district court, in issuing the order canceling the Monday session, did not say agreement in principle. It says, I've been told that that there was an agreement to settle.
Yes, and
right?
Exactly. And in that phone call, I'll tell you, Your Honor, our opposing counsel made pains to the courtroom deputy. I mean, we're outside the record now, but made pains to note to the courtroom deputy that, hold on, like, you know, we're not necessarily quite there, which is completely consistent with his email, because at that point in time on the Friday, there was no signed final agreement. Everyone knew that we still had to work it out. But what we were doing is what we do all the time in litigation. The district courts are obviously busy with hundreds of cases. When you reach an agreement in principle, you tell the district court so that they can hold the presses and devote the bandwidth to other cases that are in true litigation mode. And we're going to work
it. The district court on that same day says, the court has been notified that the parties have agreed to a settlement of this case. This is at A89, not have agreed to a settlement in principle, so I'm going to suspend everything, but I'm not going to cancel it yet because...
That's what the court wrote, but what happened is reflected is what has actually happened is reflected in the emails where the lawyers who were on the...
Do you know how big a difference it would make if that call had been recorded and actually the words in principle were used?
I don't think it would make much of a difference at all, because I think when the lawyers are sitting there in the emails saying we have an agreement, what they're talking about is we've got the foundation of the matters that have been between the business people discussed, we're now going to work out the release and the covenant. And we obviously expect we're done. And the point of the message to the district court is hold the presses on this, focus on your other cases, and if it all falls through, we'll come back to you. I mean, so that's the fundamental point.
Counsel, your time is mostly exhausted.
I will save the balance of my time. Thank you,
Your Honor. I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sternstein.
Good morning. May it please the court. What I'd like to do is maybe address primarily the questions that were raised by Your Honor during the this discussion and from the opening statement. First of all, let me address the burden of proof in this case. First of all,
is it burden of proof or standard of review?
Standard of review. I'm sorry, Your Honor. The standard of review in this case. There's a conflict of decisions in the Seventh Circuit. There is actually one case in the Seventh Circuit that recognizes the conflict, but regrettably doesn't resolve that conflict. So obviously you have the Newkirk decision that is cited by the appellants saying de novo. You have the Carr decision, which is an earlier decision, doing abuse of discretion. In the brief, the reply brief of the appellants, they say that under the Seventh Circuit rules, it is the more recent case that prevails.
Sure. Why shouldn't I look at it this way? So, the ordinary formulation of abuse of discretion says there's an abuse of discretion if there's an incorrect legal conclusion, or if there's a clearly erroneous fact finding, or if there's some sort of crazy other kind of judgment. So to say abuse of discretion is actually not yet to answer what the standard of review is for the points in dispute.
Okay.
So once you say the key point in dispute, there are two points in dispute. Was this email exchange meant to be an agreement versus an agreement in principle?
Right.
But let's say more important, whether there were essential terms missing.
Okay.
And so there's actually no conflict because the essential terms missing is a matter of law and therefore an abuse of discretion if it's incorrect as a matter of law.
Okay. I would say it a little differently, Your Honor, in the context that I think the issue to be decided, as Justice Stark was pointing out, is really a factual issue. What was the intent of the parties? And the intent of the parties is factual, and if anything, that would be clear error. All right, I think that I see. Certainly contracts are issue of law.
Did you say that in your brief? I don't know that I saw any reference.
No, we did not say that in our brief as far as the factual issue. We were simply addressing the Carr case that said abuse of discretion. In the question that was raised, that raises it into a different significance, and that's where, in response to that question, as I'm pointing out that point. All right. You have a questionable look. I don't know if I've answered
it. Oh, I always have questionable looks, so go on.
Okay. Certainly, Your Honor. So, number one, we would say abuse of discretion, and if anything, if you do go past that, we would say it's an intent issue. The next thing is, what was the intent of the parties? And if you look at what law applies to the formation, the construction, and the enforceability of a settlement agreement is the law of Indiana. The district court said that it was the law of Indiana that applied to that, and we said it was the law of Indiana that applied to that, and that was never disputed by opposing counsel, so by the appellant. So we would say it's clearly the law of Indiana. And that's an important issue because the law of Indiana is very favorable to and I would say even presumptively, to finding that a settlement agreement is valid and enforceable, all right, in the case law that we've cited.
Let me run something
sure.
by you. If we were to review the meeting of the minds or intent element for clear error and say there was no clear error in the district court's finding that there was a meeting of the minds, but also say that it's completely unambiguous and unclear what the scope of the release term, this patent portfolio term, is, where would that leave us and what would we do? There's an agreement, but with an ambiguous material term.
Okay. If it is, under Indiana law, first of all, if it is unambiguous, that's the end of it. If there's a clear intent, it's unambiguous, there's no interpretation
either
of it.
That's easy.
Okay. If it is ambiguous, under Indiana law, then the court can say, we can now look what was the intent of the parties and then still enforce the agreement. So then if you...
And where does that leave us here? You have a release to two patents, seven patents, 22 patents, or an infinite number?
I would say if the ambiguity was resolved, so you have an unambiguous agreement that there's the meetings of the mind, that's it. Keep in mind, the only thing that was asked for in our motion wasn't a definition, and the Indiana courts don't ask for a definition. We simply said, enforce the agreement and dismiss the case. And that's what the court did. The court said, I find this unambiguous, and I'm going to enforce it and dismiss the case. That's all that's necessary.
But can we simply affirm the decision
yes.
without setting forth what the agreement consisted of?
Yes. You could do it because
That leaves an argument for a future case.
That argument can be made, and that's exactly what Judge Starks was talking
about.
Could
that argument be that in the next case with patent number 8, right? Can it be that the agreement is so ambiguous that it's unenforceable?
Well, you've already had a decision that it is enforceable. So that question would be, now what is the intent?
So in order to decide that it's enforceable, we actually do need to decide whether it is sufficiently ambiguous or sufficiently unambiguous to
correct.
Be enforceable.
Correct.
So it sounds like we can't really escape dealing with the uncertainty of whether this patent covers patents 8 through 22.
Well, you're going to consider it, certainly, but what you're actually holding as opposed to what might be dicta in the case is you could say...
I thought in response to my question, you said that if we say that this is enforceable so
right.
as to dismiss this case, the
right.
question of enforceability in the next case, the other side will be precluded by.
Of enforceability, correct. The issue of enforceability would be already established. You are correct.
Okay.
The standard, as I understand it, for Indiana law would be that all essential terms need to be sufficiently definite to allow reasonable and logical interpretation. That's from the Sand
right.
case. I
correct.
Think. Are you arguing that this portfolio term could be sufficiently definite to allow reasonable and logical interpretation, even if we leave it having some degree of ambiguity above the seven patents?
If in your opinion you leave it?
Yes.
Yes. I think
and
it is.
Is that what the district court did in your view?
I think in essence it is. It granted the motion. What was the holding of the district court? The district court held that the agreement was enforceable and therefore the case was dismissed. That was actually the holding. In getting there, the district court said, well, made comments on what it might be interpreted as, but the actual holding was just, I find it unambiguous, and therefore I'm going to enforce it, and therefore the case was dismissed.
If we affirm, and there is a next case, are you reserving the right to argue that you have a license to all of their patent portfolio?
All of the patent portfolio, and I would make one correction to one part of the brief, Your Honor, all of their portfolio from patents that existed at the time of the agreement between the parties.
July 2020?
Correct, as of July of 2020.
What's the basis for that timing limit?
That timing limit was actually in the negotiations, in the what was sent by the parties. It's also explained on page 35 of our brief. Regrettably, on page 48 of our brief, when we conclude it, we did not put in that comment. But it's consistent with what we have said before.
Because I don't see that in the little four numbered points.
If you look at, and I'll dig it out, Your Honor, but if you look at page 35 of our brief, for one thing.
I'm really interested in the appendix, not your brief.
Okay. And which page in the appendix are you looking at, Your Honor?
Well, the 289 to 290 is, or, and a couple more pages is the the central set of email exchanges up to the basically up to the telephone call to the court.
Isn't it correct that as far as the discussion went about the portfolio, it was just always the phrase NeurOptics few kilometer patent portfolio, and there was no discussion of applications or date of existence of patents?
We were taking the language as it said, and that's the PPP, if you will, few kilometer patent portfolio is talking about their patent portfolio.
So,
not talking about applications. And we're saying that was an agreement reached on that date.
So I think I have the same question as Judge Toronto. Why is the date of the existence of the patents determined by the date of these emails as opposed to March 2019 when they first contacted you, or some date in the future you have a license to any applications that may materialize into patents? How do we know what you all agreed on?
I would say that if we agreed to the patents, they're talking about that date. That's why I would interpret it that
way.
Sure,
but they could be talking about patents in July 2020 that include applications that will turn into patents in 2022.
And my response would be patents that exist at that date means patents that existed that date, not something that later issues.
Does it say patents that exist at this date?
That wasn't something that is specified specifically. I would say if we're talking about patents and the agreement is that date, that's when it would be looked at. We do talk about the 152 patent. We added it in during our brief, and that's because that was a patent that did issue prior to that date. Okay, it was based on the prior patents, but it issued prior to the date of the parties. That's too what we proposed in discussions with them. So we did do that. But in looking at one of the issues that was talked about too is what is reasonable? What is a reasonable interpretation? And I would say certainly a reasonable interpretation is that it has to be all the patents. It's not just limited to seven patents. The language in the agreement was the pupillometer patent portfolio. It wasn't, there's nothing in that language that limits it to seven patents. And you do look to the outward manifestation of that, as you mentioned, in discussing that. The only outward manifestation at all between the parties that was ever raised was that the discussion in that March 27th letter that said, this is our patent portfolio on our pupillometer technology. And I would say that is no different than PPP.
Can I ask you this? Am I understanding correctly that you think that the district court's footnote referring to components is incorrect?
I would say that that's incorrect. Correct. Correct. I agree with that.
Why doesn't, and I think NeurOptics lawyer suggested this, why doesn't that either mean that it's actually pretty darn deeply uncertain what patents, even as of this date, would be covered? Because even the district court thought that patents, I don't know if it's all the entirety of a patent or just patent claims, that were limited to components would not be covered. You think, oh, no, it actually covers patents that are described in that footnote. And in any event, if the meaning is what the district court said it is, namely having to do with components, isn't it? I guess I looked at some of these other patents.
Right.
It's not self-evident to me, at least, which ones would be described as component patents.
Okay. In our view of what it is, and why I said that the district court was wrong in that footnote, Your Honor, is in why we tried to be more specific in our current briefs as to what we're talking about. Because at this point in time, we know what patents were issued by that date, by the date of the agreement. And I would say, being more specific, we're looking at the patents that are in that letter, which I'd also say is the same as PPP. And if you do look, like you said, on some of the specific patents, some of them could be construed as components to be used with a device. For example, there were basically like a contact lens that is specifically to be used with the machines for a pupillometer. So I would term that as a component. And that's why I think being as most specific as we can, we would say, take a look at that letter, and that defines it in the best way possible.
Do you have one final thought, counsel?
Yes, I would. One thing to sum it up, Your Honor, is I think if you look at what is a reasonable interpretation on this agreement, what would be reasonable is it would be that, number one, the agreement is not ambiguous, common language, common use in patent cases. If you do try and if you find some ambiguity and you want to try to fix that ambiguity or resolve that ambiguity, as the courts say, then you would be going into what is reasonable. And what is reasonable is outward manifestation. The only outward manifestation is what's in that letter, and that includes the 22 U.S. patents. And there was never, never any outward manifestation of limiting the phrase to 7 patents only.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Afrasiabi, we'll give you 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with one critical point to, I believe, your question, Judge Stark, and that is, even if it's just the 7 patents, or even if it's all 22, or even if we pick 15, we don't have clarity even as to what products this covenant and promise allegedly attaches to. It's our understanding it's only their application. They think, and you used the word...
Isn't there enough here to allow a reasonable and logical interpretation? Aren't you asking for too much?
No, because the covenant, we understand it to only attach to their product. And it to not in any way be a license to be able to go out and create new products under one of our other 18 patents, which are in, you know, medical diagnostic areas, headrests, all these things that they don't even do.
Aren't there enforceable contracts out there? We see them in court probably every day that have ambiguous terms, and that's what leads to litigation.
You have contracts with ambiguous terms, but you can't say that because there's an ambiguity, therefore a contract exists, and that's the difference. If a contract unequivocally exists, sometimes there's an ambiguity in it and there's a process to run it to ground. But the threshold question here is, under the Ochoa case from Indiana, did we even have a meeting of the minds on all the definite terms? Because if there's an ambiguity on the essential material terms, then there isn't even a contract that springs into existence. And here the covenant is...
I still don't understand why we don't review that for clear error. And the district court found there was a meeting of the minds sufficient to dismiss this case.
Well, because the standard review is de novo, but even under clear error, there's no facts in the record to even support a meeting of the mind, because the district court concluded that the meeting of the minds was on this convoluted definition, which no one has ever advanced or understood. It's indecipherable. How could there have been a meeting of the minds on that? It's impossible, because no one has said they thought that's what it meant. And we don't even know what it means today when you take that sentence and the footnote together. The other point I think I would add is, and this is critical, under the Teitke case of Indiana, if there's a construct that's reasonable on the one hand versus one on the other hand that leads to odd and unjust results, you always go with the reasonable one. Well, here, it's undisputed that the only issue was their one application, which we believed infringed 2 patents, maybe 5 more. The idea that that leads to a covenant on with a right to create new products is beyond the bounds of anything that was ever discussed anywhere. It can't have been agreed. And that's unjust. I mean, our client has explained, and it's undisputed, has invested years and tens of millions of dollars in a portfolio. Just because it sent a letter a few years ago saying that we have a portfolio doesn't mean that they now get a covenant to the whole portfolio. That's the fundamental problem.
Counsel, your time has expired, and I think we have your case, and the case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honors.
That concludes our arguments for today.